So for our first morning panel, I know we have biographies on the site in full, so I will try and be mercifully brief. And I want to just preface this by saying if you have questions for our panelists, you can enter those in the chat on our website, on YouTube, on Twitter using the hashtag CatoSpyCon. So to keep this feeling like a proper conference, please think about questions for our speakers and submit them digitally, and I will relay them to our panelists. For this first morning panel to discuss the growth of the surveillance industrial complex and its many, many facets, I'll be moderating, and we'll be joined by, to my left in person, the excellent Dana Priest, author of, she's an investigative reporter for the Washington Post, and author, co-author of Top Secret America, an account of the explosion in reliance on intelligence contractors with top secret clearances. Behind me, Kashmir Hill, who is for a long time been one of our most incisive writers on privacy and surveillance, starting with a little blog from a while ago called The Not So Private Parts, and now having, by way of Forbes, arrived as a technology reporter for the New York Times. And briefly delayed, but joining us very shortly, will be Professor Tomas Reed, who is one of the planet's foremost experts on cybersecurity and cyber war, and author, among other things, of Cyber War Will Not Take Place, and most recently, Active Measures, a history of disinformation and psychological warfare. So let's begin in just a moment with... Dana Priest and Kashmir Hill. So I guess we should start with your most recent reporting. The NSO group has recently been declared persona non grata by the State Department, was found to be, this is a group that provides, in a sense, sort of surveillance and malware services to governments around the world. Their software was found on a wide range of human rights activists and journalists' phones. Can you describe a little bit those, what you found in your investigation and why people should be concerned about that and why it's so unusual to see a private company doing what you would imagine would be the work of a not very pleasant regime's intelligence services? Oh.
Okay, well, this was a really unusual investigation by 19 media organizations, mostly in Europe, and then the Washington Post, a partner in India and Mexico. And it really needed to be worldwide because the sale of Pegasus spyware by the NSO group, which is an Israeli group of former members of the cyber unit of their intelligence agency, the 8200 group. It really is a company that sells largely to countries that can't develop their own spyware. So we're seeing, just like we did 30, 40 years ago, the proliferation of arms, Stinger missiles, things that were at the time very innovative. You know how we saw them flood the market in the South in countries that couldn't develop them themselves. We're seeing that same thing with the spyware that's very sophisticated. In fact, it's so sophisticated that it calls itself military grade, and it needs the approval of the Israeli Ministry of Defense to be sold to any particular country. And that's because Israel needs to make sure that this whatever country is in Israel's interest to sell such a weapon to. Really, it is a weapon. And then it was created, say the developers, to find and enable the capture of terrorists and criminals, so nobody would be against that. But we're seeing it being used in the Gulf states, in Mexico, in India, just in by Morocco, against civil society. And in particular, what we discovered, and it was very painstaking because we had to do forensics on people's phones. So initially, we had just 37 phones that we got people to give us to download the contents of, and to have Amnesty International's security lab look at them. We found human rights defenders, many journalists, lawyers for the human rights groups, and then activists, peaceful activists, pro-democracy activists, and opposition political figures, especially in Mexico and India. Then, as the story was first made public and named a number of countries, for instance, France, that apparently Morocco had spied on, we had indications that the Moroccans had used this equipment against French officials. So France looked at their phones, and they, within a month or so, announced that they had found that Pegasus had penetrated, or had attacked, rather, the phones of five ministers. So, of course, you know, France was a little bit upset about this, and Macron asked for a session with Israel. The same thing happened in the UK, where there were some politicians who were surveilled. The same thing happened in the US, even though at that time we had no indication that any of the equipment was used against US numbers, against the plus one numbers, and we still don't really. But recently they found that, the State Department found that 11 employees at the Ugandan embassy were attacked by Pegasus. So it's an evolving story. It's a story that has many countries looking at its own phones, at its own, and also at the intelligence agency's purchase of Pegasus, because of course it wouldn't necessarily be widely known within a particular country who is the operator. So, for instance, in Hungary, which initially denied that they had ever bought Pegasus, even now, about a month ago, admitted that yes, they did, and they were using it, no big surprise, but pretty worrisome, against a group of journalists who were particularly tenacious, doing a lot of political corruption coverage. And then we find out a number of people inside their own government. And Mexico, too, which was the first purchaser of Pegasus that we've documented, and the most frequent user of it, has said they're doing an investigation. And there in Mexico, it's internally used, whereas some states, for instance, we believe Saudi, the UAE, are using it internally, but also externally. Morocco would be on that list as well. So against people inside who are dissidents, but also dissidents abroad. And we have some belief that some of those states are working as proxies for other states in some instances.
And so has this in a sense changed your own, approach to your communication security when discovering the sort of shocking breadth of penetration?
Yeah, absolutely. The way that we had to conduct this was very laborious for those of us who really don't like to have to use, cumbersome OPSEC, as they would call it. Yeah, we had to create, I can't go into it much, but we had to create our own secure system to communicate that was different than our laptops and our cell phones. And then, you know, in the US, we weren't that worried about it, but definitely some of our partners in Hungary, we had a couple partners who were actually penetrated by Pegasus in Azerbaijan, in Mexico, in Hungary again. This little teeny group of investigative reporters called Direct 36, two of their reporters had been attacked by Pegasus. And yet they were not only willing to cooperate with the investigation, but they've continued to do some of the best work inside Hungary. So it was a very, it was a unique experience working on it. I wouldn't say again that I've changed a lot of practices. I always recommend that people try not to use this technology, that they try to get together with people. That's the surest way to defeat electronic surveillance, but it's difficult, especially during COVID. But I wanted to say one more thing, which is this, to me, is the evolution of what we documented in Top Secret America, which was that this technology, these contractors, they all grew up in the era of 9/11. And as a result of 9/11, the result of first the US government just throwing money, the Congress throwing money at the intel and military agencies in order to make sure another attack never happened, and yet don't grow government, God forbid. So who do you turn to? Contractors. And as we saw, more and more contractors within government said, or more and more people within government said, why am I working here when I can make twice as much doing the same thing and no accountability or less accountability for contractors? So we saw, and that's what we documented in Top Secret America, this huge proliferation all over the country in certain pockets. We called it an alternative geography of the United States because they were all, these contractors were clustered around the big agencies. And we are seeing the use, the repurposing of military equipment, military tools that were used on the battlefield. The battlefield is not there in the same way that it was. The companies don't want to shut down, and they're finding other ways to use their equipment. And it's everywhere. It's largely unregulated in outside of the United States. Outside of Europe, I think even Europe recognizes it has a big problem with regulating some of the companies that originate in Europe and Israel as well, which I'd like to talk about later more because there's particularly a particular twist that's very interesting mm-hmm. when it comes to Israeli companies.
Okay, I'm interested in all making it to circle back to that, but I want to turn to Kashmir because speaking of being worrying about being monitored by the very company you're reporting on. I know Kashmir has done excellent work on a little company called Clearview AI, which specializes in face recognition, and has, in a sense, found herself being roped into the story. Kash, what you can sort of, I guess, explain to people who may not have heard of it what Clearview is and how you became involved in reporting on them.
Yeah, so Clearview AI is kind of is a different type of creature. It's in that cluster of surveillance contractors who have collected data in mass and made it searchable. So kind of like an automated license plate reading company or a drone company that's doing aerial footage. Except Clearview AI went online and collected billions of public photos. At the time I wrote about them, it was 3 billion. They now say they have over 10 billion and essentially made them searchable by face because facial recognition algorithms have just gotten so much better in the last decade than they were thanks to neural net technology. And so they created this tool where you take a photo of somebody and it'll show you all the photos they have in their database that they also think are that person. And so this can be useful to leading back to someone's identity. And Clearview AI was originally planning on selling its tool to private industry. It thought it would be a great tool for, the hospitality industry or real estate firms to vet the people that are walking into the lobbies. But at some point they met with police officers and police officers said, this would be an amazing tool for us. And so they started selling it to local police departments. And this is kind of an inversion, I think, of what usually happens with kind of surveillance or military equipment, that it trickles down from the military or from federal agencies to local police departments. Clearview AI actually climbed it up from local departments to federal agencies, which is kind of fascinating. But yeah, so when I first started, I feel like Dana is going to laugh about this because when I first started investigating Clearview AI, I am a person who usually writes about corporate privacy, consumer privacy. I don't usually report on surveillance companies. And when I first started reporting on Clearview AI, there was very little about them publicly available. I was able to track some people who seemed connected to the company, but no one would talk to me. And so at first I was able to learn very little about the company because they wouldn't talk to me. So I knew that police officers were using the tool. So I started trying to figure out which police departments were using it and connecting with police officers, detectives, asking about the tool, how they used it. And there I found people who were actually very willing to talk to me. The first person was a detective in Gainesville who does financial crimes. And so he basically, you know, somebody goes to an ATM, pulls money out, and has done so fraudulently, you know, in, you know, pulling from somebody else's account. So they have a photo of him. And he said, this has been great. It's identifying so many people that I haven't been able to identify previously because they weren't in state databases, and this facial recognition tool works, you know, so much better than the tools I've been using before. And he's like, and I said, well, I'd love to see what the results look like. Like, could you do that? And he said, sure, send me your photo and I'll run it and I'll show you the results. And so I sent him my photo, and I sent him three photos actually, because he had told me it works well in many different ways, like whether somebody's wearing sunglasses or has a hat or their face is partially covered. Excuse my fingernail polish, my 5-year-old painted my nails. And so I sent the photo to him. He'd been so excited to talk to me before this, but as soon as I sent him the photo, he stopped responding to any of my messages. He wouldn't take my phone calls. And so I kept talking to other detectives. I talked to another detective in Texas, and he said the same thing. I'd love to show you what it's like, send me your photo. So I sent him my photo, and he ran it through the tool, which is just an iPhone app. And he said, oh, you don't have any results. There are no photos of you that are getting pulled up. And I said, that's so strange, because there's a lot of photos of me online. And he said, yeah, it must be a bug. You know, maybe their servers are down. And then he also stopped talking to me. And it wasn't until the third time that this happened that I figured out what was happening. Sent a photo to somebody, they ran my photo, there were no results. And then the officer got a call from Clearview AI within 10 minutes of running my photo. And the person asked, you know, why are you talking to a New York Times reporter? Why are you running this woman's photo? And they shut down his account. And it made me realize that Clearview AI, while they were kind of refusing to talk to me, they were monitoring me because they had flagged my face. And so this was, you know, kind of alarming for me that I was, you know, my reporting, my sources were being tracked this way. I also felt like an idiot having asked people to run my photo in the first place. But it also meant that Clearview AI had access to every face that law enforcement was running and the ability to block somebody from having results, which is quite a huge power for, you know, a facial recognition vendor that is now used by, I think, thousands of different agencies. So, you know, I felt like an idiot in a way, but it was a very illustrative idiocy.
I mean, it occurs to me there's a version of this, right, that is a nice story where... you know, they're saying, hey, why are you running the photo of a New York Times reporter? That's potentially inappropriate or abusive. But it sounds like that's not what you think was going on.
Well, when I asked, you know, I eventually the company started talking to me. And when I interviewed Juan Tontat, the CEO of the company, he's a developer, grew up in Australia, moved to San Francisco during the kind of the internet boom there, developed apps, used to do like iPhone games, and he did Facebook games, iPhone games, photo app, where you could put Trump's hair on anybody that was in your photo. I mean, really kind of silly things before hitting upon this very powerful and popular tool, popular for law enforcement at least. I asked him about this. I said, you know, I had this problem where my photo wasn't having any results. He said, oh, you know, that was just a bug and we fixed that now. And he ran the app on my face during our interview, and it pulled up many photos. And then actually this was before COVID, but I did cover my face with my hands like this. He took another photo and it still did pool a number of photos. Facial recognition really has grown quite powerful. But yes, so he said it was, you know, he said it was a bug.
The bug that yielded a phone call, apparently.
Right,
very sophisticated.
Yes, but we kind of talked about it more. We talked about it more after that, and he said, yes, they do feel they want to have some kind of monitoring, that they recognize their tool is powerful, but that the monitoring they're providing now is to the agencies, making sure that there's a trail that police departments can audit, you know, that you have to have case numbers associated with different searches, et cetera, so that, you know, police officers aren't just using it when they're out at a bar on the weekends to figure out who somebody is.
I mean, so I guess it's better than them not doing something, although you wonder how would they, you know, detect it if someone is, you know, for example, running a photo of a romantic partner without kind of creepily detailed knowledge. But, you know, it occurs to me that this implies, you know, okay, so it would be good if they were looking at something like that, but also that, you know, this would effectively entails sort of outsourcing the oversight function here to the company itself. So we're sort of asking, you know, ideally, right? You imagine these are the executive agencies that are using these tools, and then oversight by other elements, ideally independent elements of the public sector. Here you have the company that is, you know, selling this tool and presumably wants to continue to be able to sell it, using its own, I suppose, discretion and to try and conduct that oversight. Is that something that worries you? And to what extent is you know, are they in a kind of a unique position to do that in a way that might displace other forms of oversight? I mean, would a local government be able to do the same kind of thing without robust assistance from Clearview?
Well, I think for Clearview AI specifically, it's been a real learning curve being a you know, a government contractor as opposed to what they originally planned to be, which was you know, in grocery stores helping to identify customers so clerks could greet them by name, and so the oversight that they're doing now, they are creating oversight for the departments to do. I don't think that they are trying to scan the photos for abuse anymore. They're creating mechanisms so that departments can do it. And so then it's just a question of whether the departments are, you know, auditing the use of the tool or not. And yeah, it's you know, I talked to ICE is one of the agencies that started using the tool very early on. They use it as it's often happens with these surveillance tools. It starts with the children. They were using it in their CSAM unit to try to identify abusers that were in photos with kids. And you know, I talked to the director of that unit, who they eventually ended up buying Clearview AI. I think that they now have a $500,000 contract with the company, and you know, she says that they do a lot of oversight, that you have to make special requests to use this tool, that they will, you know, only use it for some types of use cases and not others. And at the time I talked to her, which was last year, she said basically she had to approve like any use of Clearview AI, which is interesting. I mean, I actually think the fundamental question of Clearview AI is a difficult one. I mean, it is such a superpower to be able to see someone's face and pull up all the other photos of them online. It is radical, it is transformative, it is something we have not been able to do before. At the same time, it is just Google. It's a Google for someone's face. Instead of looking for somebody by name, you're looking for them by face. There's no real private information here. It's just pulling up public images. And so the people that I talked to about it within law enforcement, some are very kind of scared of the public perception that they're abusing of face recognition tools. And so they have, you know, stringent processes, but other people just say, you know, this is just Google. Like, I don't understand why it's such a big deal.
I have a question. you know, when you marry up that capability with the publicly funded surveillance cameras that are everywhere now, you know, it sounds like another way, it sounds like an equivalent to DNA or fingerprinting. And both of those require some process to get a, you know, a civilian to turn over that. So my question is, in police departments, are there rigorous rules? Are they using some kind of process to say, you cannot search for this person's face unless you have probable cause or something?
There are not a lot of rules around facial recognition. So it really seems to vary from department to department. The way Clearview AI got its start, and this was very surprising to me, though now I understand it's kind of standard with local police departments, but is Clearview AI ran ads in, for example, CrimeDex, a listserv for financial crime investigators, and just said, try Google for faces, you know, stop searching, start solving, try Clearview AI for free. And you would just send the company, you know, your email address. And if it was associated with a police department, they would just send you the app and let you download it and start using it. And so initially, the you know, the officers who were using Clearview AI were just doing so very independently. Probably did not know the rules, because typically with, you know, the state databases or the national databases, the FBI's national database, DMV photos, there's a whole special unit, facial recognition unit, that you send photos to, and they come back to you with results. And so I think something that has happened as a result of Clearview AI getting so much attention is that those units have kind of sucked up Clearview AI into their oversight, into their domain, and that it's not something just any officer can have on their phone. But that is, initially, it was just officers getting it on their phone and trying it out on photos they had of suspects they hadn't been able to identify.
Wow. I mean, this is, you know, you think of the sort of Silicon Valley catchphrase, you know, people try to move fast and break things. That is the idea that, you know, often tech companies aim to, you know, launch something that's sort of so novel that the kind of rules are not in place for it yet. So it's, you know, sort of disruptive innovation that then you end up building a structure out. And it's perhaps a little more disconcerting even to think about, you know, police departments and intelligence agencies operating on that model, that is deploying technology that's sort of sufficiently novel that there isn't actually a framework in place for it. And I think that's maybe something of a pattern we see, you know, over time, is that you have sort of novel technological methods that are, you know, discovered and then employed, often not very publicly for years before anyone bothers to, you know, build any kind of framework of rules governing how that method or how this technology should be used. Is that something that you, when you looked at intelligent contractors, is that a phenomenon that you saw of the sort of the rules lagging the novelty of the methodology?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the difference was intelligence agencies, by and large, look overseas. So our rules for doing that overseas are very liberal. But it does remind me of, say, Stingray and some of the other cell phone tower use, which, by the way, came from the battlefield and from Intel world first, that local agencies were so thankful to have, probably mostly for good reason, but there was no law that regulated it. So I did want to ask you whether, are there legislators now who have taken up the idea of trying to regulate the use or come up with guidelines that could somehow be, especially at the local level, where communities might have no idea, And officers may, you know, if there's no rules, they may not have a set of guidelines that they follow.
There have been, so in a few cities and states, we've seen moves to put a moratorium on facial recognition. It's been banned in San Francisco City Council, banned it, Oakland, basically all the suburbs around Boston. In terms of regulating, so I've seen departments like, so Detroit Police Department had two incidents of wrongfully identifying somebody with facial recognition and arresting them. And they spent time in jail as a result of it. And, you know, what police officers always tell me is that facial recognition is only supposed to be a lead, and it's supposed to lead to further investigation before you arrest somebody. And that's part of the reason why there's so few rules around it, because it's just supposed to be the start of the investigation and not what the arrest is based on. But as you might imagine, you know, sometimes, you know, this magical tool tells you this is your person, and then you are able to kind of you have the confirmation bias, and you just start finding all these reasons to justify it. So basically poor investigations in Detroit. And so Detroit decided they're only going to use facial recognition in the case of, you know, major crimes, that they won't use it for shoplifting or minor things. So I've seen that kind of regulation and the bans, but.
Well, what about really political rallies? What about peaceful political rallies? You know, we've had so many of them over the last year. Have you found instances where departments were using that just on crowds?
Or for that matter, you know, political rallies where, you know, someone breaks a window. There's, you know, it's not 100% peaceful, but
yeah,
but lots and lots of people who are not, who are being peaceful are there.
I mean, facial recognition has certainly been part of the investigation into the January 6th riot. And with the Black Lives Matter protest earlier, there have been uses, usually when there was some kind of violence within the crowd, somebody threw a rock. I have not yet seen it used on a peaceful protester. But, you know, in terms of defining what is a crime, there can be a lot of leeway there, especially in protests, which are often about, you know, disrupting a space. So yeah, I mean, this is, I think police departments are supposedly, you know, watching for this, but there's not clear rules. These are rules that the police departments are making internally, that they won't, you know, use these in ways that violate people's civil rights.
I mean, you can imagine though, them collecting just hundreds of faces at a rally and keeping them in a database just to see, you know, for further cross referencing. Are there any rules about doing that, about keeping people's faces in some sort of database to use? You know, because I'm thinking of the, even under the Snowden revelations, that they had a time sensitive, you know, they had a time where they had to purge things out of their databases at the federal level.
And I know the FBI operations manual, the DIOG, as they call it, would have rules about not retaining that kind of thing. But local, not necessarily. It would be a matter of internal rules rather than, I think, federal law.
Whether you could see all sorts of abuses for that. You know, if you had one set of protesters and then everyone else who was an elected official was of a different ilk, you know, at some point they could just use the faces in the database to start harassing people in many different ways.
Yeah, there was an incident in, I believe it was Ukraine a few years back, where and this was not using face recognition, but more stingray-like technology, where attendees at a public protest had received text messages to apprise them that the authorities were aware that they had been present at this location at this time. But one can imagine pretty easily a face recognition version of the same kind of automated notification and chilling.
I've seen it in Hong Kong. Face recognition was being used during the protest.
Yeah, I want to actually touch a little bit on the sort of the relationship between, when we talk about the sort of the surveillance industrial complex, between sort of the obvious components, the NSO group and the Clearviews, the intelligence contractors, but in a lot of ways, they're often sort of parasitic on the, in a sense, the kind of private voluntary surveillance industry. That is, the companies that are increasingly storing large amounts of data that we have, with varying degrees of willingness, ourselves given up, right? Clearview, would you say is right that Clearview would not really be possible without Facebook, at least not in anything like its current form?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, so they've scraped many, many, many sites, but Instagram is one that comes in a lot. I mean, LinkedIn, Venmo, I would say, really the power of Facebook was, I mean, I think Facebook was one of the first companies to really convince us all to put public photos of ourselves on the internet right next to our names. And, you know, this is a result of the way that we have lived online for the last two decades, that most of us do have many photos. And even those who don't, I mean, it's one of the officers I talked to, one of the first things that Clearview AI encouraged them to do was to use the app on themselves to see how well it worked. And this detective told me he'd been very careful not to put public photos of himself on the internet because of the work that he does, you know, kind of just not wanting to have much information about himself available to people that he is arresting, leading to their prosecution. So he ran the app on himself, and a photo came back from Twitter. And it was from some kind of festival where he had been on patrol, and he was kneeling in the back of someone else's photo. There's some people posing in front of him, and there he was, you know, with his badge on, just clearly identifiable. And this is why, I mean, facial recognition is for undercover police officers. You know, we're seeing it, that recent report from the CIA where they say this is such a problem for their informants now, that it's just too easy to track people with this technology. It can be a real problem.
Do you know much about its sale overseas?
So initially Clearview AI was trying to sell overseas. It first focused on the US market and the Canadian market, and it was starting to make inroads overseas, but it pulled back after its existence became public. About a year after they'd started selling to law enforcement, that I wrote the article about them in the New York Times. And there was such a backlash and international investigations. Since then, Canada has ruled that Clearview AI is illegal. Australia has said it is illegal. The UK has said it is illegal. They ordered the firm to delete photos of their citizens, and has said that, you know, they can't sell this tool there without getting their citizens' consent to be part of it. Mm. And I mean, it just illustrates the fact that the US just has no strong federal privacy law. Yeah. That this app is actually illegal in other countries, but there's very little here that has been done since Clearview AI has been made public. There's lawsuits in Illinois. The Vermont Attorney General sued the company, and that suit is ongoing. But other than that, there's kind of been little.
Hmm. Well, little, you know, and you would really worry about the places that Pegasus is used, right? In all the authoritarian and rising authoritarian countries. And what's to prevent someone else from becoming the next Clearview?
This is, you know, that is, I think, the bigger concern is, this is technology that is out there now. I mean, what they have done is they've scraped the internet and paired it with a really good facial recognition algorithm. And that is something a copycat company could do. I mean, any of the tech companies could have released this, yeah. Google, Facebook, any of them could have done it. And they didn't because it was too taboo. And Clearview AI basically broke through that taboo. And I could definitely, you know, there's already another tool called PimEyes, which is a kind of public version of this. It doesn't work as well as Clearview AI when I've looked at it, but it is there, and I do think that there will be others.
I would think that there are others that we don't know about because they're being sold exclusively to governments overseas. You know, perhaps, again, just like Pegasus.
We had a question from Chip Pitts, who I know is someone active in this space here in DC, who wanted to first to thank you for your reporting, but was also a fan of your book, Top Secret America, and was hoping you might speak to how things have evolved since that book was written. What have you sort of seen evolving in this space since then? Is it better or worse? What are the new entrants that you find most concerning?
I do, you know, we've seen the budget stay the same, not really shrink as much as you would imagine it would after two hot wars, no longer being there. But I'm not sure we won't at some point, but it's difficult to cut back. Honestly, what I see is more of the technology being used domestically. Mm-hmm. And partly because of the issues that we've talked about, which is the lack of regulation at the federal level, and then certainly not at the state or local level, except with some exceptions, California, Canada, I'm sure there are other places as well. So I really do see, you know, you can even see it in every time there's a potentially violent incident in a city, you see these people you see the police in military vehicles and military uniforms and military weapons. So that's our visual access to what was probably mainly a foreign tools created after 9/11. But I do think that, you know, we are seeing more surveillance, all the tools. You know, I love the cell phone tower example, because I can't tell you how hard I had to work to get that, to figure out that this was this amazing tool that that the intelligence community had developed that was being used by NSA in the battlefield when we didn't know that they had an expeditionary, you know, unit or units. And it was such a preciously guarded piece of equipment because it was so powerful and invasive and so efficient. You know, I mean, when you looked at it, you're like, good for you, you know. Now it's here. And is it here with any kind of due process? I don't know. And I would guess that it varies from place to place.
Now, you touched on how closely guarded it was. I know one of the things that has worried people about Stingray in particular is the way they effectively blocked disclosure of the details of the operation of the technology. There have been criminal defendants, for example, who you know, have wanted to contest whether they had been accurately geolocated at a particular place, wanted technical information to be able to have their own experts analyze it for potential problems. And then effectively the prosecution had to say, well, no, we have a contract that says this is their proprietary information. These are trade secrets. And so we have to refuse. You know, a lot of what we're talking about is activity that, if it were done directly by government agencies, would be often subject to FOIA or local Freedom of Information Act requests. There would be mechanisms for folks like yourself to get information. And of course, there's all sorts of exceptions, but formally, at least, in the absence of an exception, that would have to be turned over. Because one of the FOIA exceptions we know is commercial or proprietary information. So to what extent does it, in practice, make it more difficult for you guys to to sort of ferret out the nature of these tools when they move from kind of direct public control to contractor control?
Oh, yeah. And also when they move into the law enforcement sensitive arena, you know, there are a lot of exemptions from FOIA. What you do have, luckily, I remember how Stingray was unveiled, is you have defense attorneys. So even though the initial criminal investigation may not mention a product, there have been very clever, actually, you probably don't even have to be that clever to spot, you know, how did you figure out that my guy with the cell phone was getting off a bus and all your officers just had to you know, just appeared. So we do have, you know, luckily here, we do have, because we have rule of law and all the processes that that involves, we have people who are going to have access just by the nature of being involved with that in an adversarial way. We're likely to have more success than you would at the intelligence level, you know, finding out what's going on. But that does bring up my favorite topic, which is the sad evaporation of local news and state news. I mean, we just have fewer investigative reporters that will be able to do this kind of work, and that's a real crisis as well. Especially when you look at who has it been that have, you know, unearthed a lot of this. It really has been a combination of reporters, and I want to give a big shout out to the forensics people in Amnesty International's Security Lab, at Citizen Lab, and other do-good organizations that are now training students to help them, you know, create a new army of people that will be in this business, be in a business that we, you know, I as a journalist certainly cannot be in, and rely on them and their work to do things like do forensics on cell phones to look for Pegasus. That's a real, it's a skill, and more people are getting into it, which is great.
It seems like one of the reasons that we're finding this reliance on external firms is, you know, it used to be for a lot of the 20th century, if you were interested in questions like cryptography and the mathematics of secure communications, that essentially that was something, you know, NSA and a right. handful of other large intelligence agencies were doing, and if that was the kind of work you wanted to do, you went to work for them, or they found you and told you should go work for them. And they would actually work pretty hard to kind of put a lid on mm-hmm. research along those lines outside those walls. Whereas now, of course, that's sort of a huge business. And so it's sort of not reasonable to expect that sort of the best minds on something like computer security or technology will be found within the intelligence agencies, which usually, you know, can't pay as much as
right.
Google or. So, I mean, does that create a sort of an issue where, you know, partly just on sort of economic grounds, it's in a sense necessary to rely on those outside parties, because you kind of can't expect to hire Google caliber talent and have that be, you know, someone who spends a 30-year career at the FBI.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think this is the driving force for all this. You know, the market, the desire to make money, people who can so easily move outside of the intelligence community, and now it's culturally acceptable in a way that it was not 40 years ago. You know, 40 years ago, people went into teaching or something. They didn't go and make a bunch of money off of things that they were taught in the intelligence world. In fact, it's gotten so bad that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, I believe it was that, and could have been the CIA, sent out a memo to former Intel people saying they were addressing actually tradecraft. So they weren't addressing technology, but it was a big caution. Look at you. These are classified things. They didn't put it this way, but this is what they were saying. These can harm the U.S. national security interests if sold to the wrong people. You know, beware of what you're doing. What they were really addressing, my sources said, was the transfer of tradecraft, which is even more. You need technology, but you need the tradecraft to make it a real tool. And the tradecraft, first of all, it's learned in the classified world. So that means by its very nature, you are taking classified information and giving it to another country that may then use it in a way that is not to our advantage. And who is policing that? You know, I think it's very difficult to police. And this brings me to the topic I wanted to mention with Israel in particular. You know, the Israeli intelligence services, I think, and I'm told by people within the USIC, have a much more strategic, holistic view of contracting and the ICE and government agencies. In other words, they welcome people going from one into contracting with the idea that those contractors are going to still be very loyal to the state and that there will be an informal exchange of information. And this is the way it is, and it's been like that for a long time. So, I mean, that means, I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing. I'm saying Israel encourages it, and you can see if you go to Boston, you know, there's just so many Israeli former intel people who are working in cutting-edge technologies and startup firms and this sort of thing. But the one, you know, but the IC in the U.S. remains suspicious about it because Israel is going to be the benefactor, and even though Israel is an ally, its interests are not always aligned with ours. So you can look at it as a good thing. Some of the people in the IC said, I wish that we had that kind of holistic view of former officials. But you can also look at it the other way, which is, you know, and in the case of Pegasus, one of the great stories that we touched on, but really not that much, is that Benjamin Netanyahu was using the sale of this technology as a diplomatic tool in the Gulf to make better relations with Saudi, the UAE, and other countries. Not Qatar, I don't think, but and he would go to those countries and pitch Pegasus. So it was being used by him to open doors diplomatically, and that has evolved into more traditional diplomacy as well, as we saw, I think, even this week, Bennett went to the UAE for the first time. So they're using it as a geopolitical tool as well.
I mean, we do see, I think, some of the sort of the revolving door there in the U.S. I think more commonly you think of senior IC people then going out to sit on the board of some contract company. Clearview seems like an odd sort of almost exception, right? In that you're saying it was not really envisioned as an intelligence contractor. And you still talk about it as primarily sort of marketing to law enforcement. Do you see it moving into the intelligence space?
Clearview AI?
Yeah.
I mean, they already have. The GAO did the recent report on facial recognition, asking who's already using facial recognition, who's planning to, and surveyed a bunch of federal agencies. And I mean, it's already being used by DOJ, FBI, ICE. I mean, it's a very useful tool. I certainly have talked to a lot of officers who have found it incredibly useful in their investigations. Again, always emphasizing it's just the start of the investigation. It's just a lead. And it says this every time you get a facial recognition report back when you go through the official channels and have them search state databases. It says, you know, this is not probable cause. You cannot arrest based on this. But yes, it is clearly spreading through the government.
I would think that IC already has a version of this. Honestly, you know, when there were so many problems with insider threats in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think they developed mass surveillance tools. Have you noticed a change in the board membership of Clearview? Have they brought people in with more foreign experience or top level domestic law enforcement?
Yeah, they just brought in a bunch of new board members that they announced in the last couple of months, including Richard Clark. But yes, they have.
Yeah.
So that seems to be another pattern we see, right, is these relationships where you know, I mean, this is familiar from, right, the military context as well, that the way you sort of make your retirement comfortable after a couple decades in government service is to sit on the board of a contractor, sort of selling things to the agencies you used to work for. And you know, one of the things that's sort of, I think, a commonplace in security studies is that the effect of that is to, let's say, you know, create a dynamic where there's a fair amount of lobbying for expenditures on military technology that is, you know, sometimes of dubious actual efficacy. We've certainly seen instances in the intelligence space of very expensive projects that, you know, stretch on for years, go over budget, and don't necessarily work or yield in much of operational value. As you were talking about the, I mean, it sounded almost like the, you know, the upbeat marketing of Clearview to law enforcement, you know, hey, stop searching and start solving, which is, you know, maybe not the way you ideally think of kind of procurement decisions being made for intrusive technologies. How do you see that aspect playing out? That is the sort of the interface between the sort of the commercial interest, right? We've got a product that we want to sell, and, you know, the decision-making process about how to decide whether a technology you know, needs to be used. Is this something that are there things that end up getting adopted because they're being sort of sold as this sort of sexy product? In a way that something developed in-house probably wouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, I I think what was very effective here, and my understanding from talking to officers, is that this happens a lot. I mean, a lot of these vendors have learned that this is the way to get adopted by police departments, have the officers clamoring for the tool, and going to their procurement officer and saying, I've already used this. This has already helped me solve cases. We need to have this tool. I mean, ICE, the first case that ICE used it on was Yahoo found CSAM in a Syrian user's account. And there were some known images, which is how it got flagged by PhotoDNA.
For viewers who may not know that acronym, CSAM is child sexual abuse material. So images of children experiencing sexual abuse.
Some of the images included a young girl getting abused, and it was an image that law enforcement had not seen before. And the investigator who was on it, it was clearly in the US, they could tell from the background of the photo, like the electrical outlets. It was this girl is somewhere in the US. And so the agent who got this, you know, took a screenshot of the abuser's face. He had included his face, which is kind of unusual, but sometimes apparently you do this because you're trying to basically join a group of other people who are sharing these images. And he sent it out as kind of a bolo to other child crime investigators and said, has anybody seen this guy before? And one of the people who got it was an investigator based in New York who was already using Clearview AI. And so she ran it and sent him a photo. And it was this Instagram photo of somebody at a bodybuilding convention. And the people who posed for the photo were not the suspect, but the suspect was behind them working a kind of vendor counter. And so the investigator was able to go from there and figure out who the guy was, and they arrested him within a month, and he still had the child in his custody, so they were able to, you know, save the child. But anyways, you know, he Clearview AI was what broke this case for them, and so ICE decided, based off that case, we're going to get a license to use this tool. But that's how this was tending to happen. They're using it in their cases, in active cases, which was shocking to me. I mean, this Clearview AI only recently had its algorithm tested by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. NIST has been testing facial recognition algorithms for the last 20 years. Clearview was used by police for almost 3 years until it had its algorithm tested for accuracy. And so that really shocked me that the vetting that you're doing of this forensic tool is just happening in terms of kind of trial and error. Is it working on your cases? And they, so they were tested by NIST. They did quite well. They do have, you know, one of the top kind of 10 algorithms in terms of accuracy in testing under test conditions. But still, it was pretty shocking to me that that is how it was making its way into officers' hands.
I mean, it almost reminds me of like the, sort of the Uber model, right? Which is, it's not clear this is strictly legal in a lot of regions, but if you start up and get it running, you will create enough of a constituency for the product that the rules will be changed to accommodate the sort of the facts on the ground.
And the marketing to officers, I remember when I did the domestic side of Top Secret America, I went to Memphis, Tennessee, where they had a real-time crime lab, which was at that time the first of its kind. And now if you look on the surveillance atlas that is available online, and Burl's going to talk about that later, I think, you'll see all of Tennessee is like a real-time crime center now, it seems like. And they were using FLIR in the helicopters, which at that time was a very controversial product because it was so invasive and it had been used mainly by the military, and they got a hold of it somewhere. And, you know, of course, FLIR is everywhere now and it's no big deal, but at a time it was thought to be so invasive that it shouldn't be used against U.S. citizens. So, I mean, it's so predictable what's going to happen. I'm sure they have a lobbyist now on Capitol Hill. And to the question that the viewer asked, that's one reason Top Secret America hasn't shrunk, because there's been a consolidation of a lot of the smaller companies into the bigger companies, and bigger companies still have a lot of sway on Capitol Hill. So I would expect that that's what's going to happen with Clearview. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, and the only place where Clearview can't currently be used is Illinois, because Illinois has this the really kind of an incredible law, in that it's the rare time that the law was moving faster than the technology. It passed the Biometric Information Privacy Act in 2008, which says that a company needs to get a citizen's permission, a resident's permission, before using their biometric information, including their face print. Mm. And so this is the one place where Clearview AI has run into trouble. They had to delete Illinoisians from its database, and it's fighting a class action lawsuit there and a state lawsuit. It's been sued by the ACLU. Floyd Abrams is their lawyer, and they're, you know, one of their arguments is that they have this First Amendment right to collect this data, that they're just processing public information, and that is not something that can be criminalized by the state. That hasn't been a successful argument at the state level so far, but it does seem like one of these cases that could possibly make its way to the Supreme Court in this question of whether biometric privacy is something that can be protected. But yeah, I mean, unless the U.S. passes a law that is like other countries have, that say that you really do need citizens' consent to process their information, or specifically our face prints are protected, I do think Clearview has a pretty clear path in front of them of being able to keep selling their tool.
Well, the other thing it reminds me of, I teach a class, I'm actually a professor at the University of Maryland's Journalism School, and I have a class about censorship and disinformation. And we talk all the time about technologies that are, Facebook in particular, that are undermining democracies throughout the world because they're not doing content moderation, like they say, and because their algorithms favor extremism and polarization. That's how they make money. So when you look at what Europe's doing with the GDPR and other things, privacy laws, you know, it is real, and this, I would bet that they have laws against this kind of Clearview technology, but they definitely have laws that are gonna impact the sale of Pegasus, or the use of Pegasus against civilians. Europe is really ahead of the US in addressing technologies in general, and that you know, reflects, you know, poor Ron Wyden is still like the one voice on surveillance. He's been the one voice, you know, or the most prominent voice for 30 years. Maybe we need, or maybe we actually have, and I don't know, a new committee that is filled with people who understand the consequences of unregulated both social media and the cutting edge stuff that you're talking about. Because if Congress can't get its handle on this, you know, nobody will, or it'll be so piecemeal that that I think companies will find ways to get around it if it's piecemeal. And yeah, do you see any of that happening? Do you see regulators, you know, Congress? I mean, they're not even worked up anymore about what happened in the 2016 election with Facebook and the Russians and now the Chinese. And
yeah, I mean, it seems like in the U.S. we've just relied so long on, you know, the technology industry to self-govern.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's been interesting in the Clearview AI case, because a bunch of these companies, LinkedIn, Venmo, Facebook, they sent Clearview AI cease and desist letters saying you're violating, you know, our terms of service by taking the photos and using it this way. And then crickets, they sent cease and desist letters and nothing after that. There's been, you know, so supposedly these are the companies are supposed to be safeguarding our photos, and they haven't gone after Clearview AI. They have not sued them. They have beyond kind of the anti-scraping technologies that they have on place on their sites, which obviously failed here, you know, they haven't done anything. So the technology industry is not kind of leaping into the action the way that I think regulators, you know, or lawmakers kind of expected as they passed no laws around this.
Well, and the same thing is happening with Pegasus. WhatsApp has sued NSO, the parent company, because they discovered that Pegasus was used WhatsApp to get into phones. And now Apple has sued NSO Group because of its use of Apple vulnerabilities to get into phones. So again, though, that is piecemeal. The courts only have so far they can go, you know, when you're facing these very tricky questions of First Amendment. You know, it's not gonna be solved in lawsuits, I don't think.
You know, something that came up here was the issues of different jurisdictions having different rules that you know, permit or block the usage of some of these private technologies. But I was mulling how, in a sense, odd it is that we find, you know, countries increasingly reliant on not just, you know, their domestic firms, but firms based elsewhere to do this kind of essential intelligence work. The FBI controversy around the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone and whether they could find a way to access that was ultimately resolved by, I think it was another Israeli firm that found a vulnerability that was usable. And that just seems like an odd tension, because you have the sector of government that is, in a sense, right, the most xenophobic normally.
Yeah.
Right. There's a classification marking NOFORN, N-O-F-O-R-N, right? It's whatever else this, you know, this can't be shown to foreign nationals. And then saying, you know, for this critical intelligence work, we're gonna have a company that's outside our jurisdiction be in charge of providing the service. And, you know, of course, the U.S. intelligence community still is primarily relying on U.S. companies, but this is increasingly a kind of global market, and very often, you know, countries are purchasing that don't have the sort of the in-house capability. I wonder if either of you have some thoughts on this idea of a kind of transnational, I guess, sort of intelligence apparatus that is not really bound to any particular government.
No, and honestly, this is another really important argument why these things need to be regulated. Because ultimately, so I'll take the UAE as an example. Longtime user of Pegasus, although we think that now NSO Group stopped selling to at least some of the operators in UAE. I don't know if it's all of them, because they won't say. But then the UAE has, well, now they've spent tens of billions of dollars to create their own capability. So there was a transfer, I'm not saying of Pegasus, but there's definitely a transfer of intellectual tradecraft, whatever, to the UAE so that it can now have its own technology, its own apparatus, to its own infrastructure, everything. Is that in the US interest? So is that in the US national security interest? So these technologies play a very big role in issues that do affect US national security. And yet we don't regulate them in a way that takes into account that important aspect of this. Again, that's the same way as social media. You know, why isn't what Facebook does an interest of national security? Because again, its lack of monitoring what happens, just take, you know, one example. In the Philippines, where Maria Ressa, journalist who just won the Nobel Peace Award for her efforts to chronicle Duterte's corruption, but also to get Facebook to be responsible in the Philippines, where they're being used by Duterte's colleagues and to undermine democracy. Why isn't the undermining of democracy through Facebook a US national security concern? Why isn't the undermining of US democracy through Facebook with disinformation a US national security concern? I think it's a very short-sighted view of what social media is all about, of what the mechanism behind our communicating with our friends and family. I mean, so far beyond that.
So what would the regulatory intervention be then? I mean, this is a little...
Well, you go back to the algorithm. What does the algorithm do? The algorithm is programmed to create division through emotional content that drives people to the edges of extremism. This is so well documented now. So they make money off of an algorithm and a product that does that. So it pushes people unconsciously, not knowing, it pushes people to the extremes with disinformation that doesn't...
Do we think that some of these things wouldn't happen?
Not on a scale. Okay, and so why is that business model permitted? Honestly, why is that business model okay? When we don't do it in other realms, you know, in other realms, I think it would be so much more visible, for one thing. And the fact that that is not something that that Congress is looking at is, you know, I think...
And would you accept that for the Washington Post if someone said that you're running articles that are divisive and promoting?
Well, if that's mainly what we did, then I would, you know, definitely question. And if we made most of our money off of emotional content that was fabricated or not real, you know, or disinformation, then I would think hopefully that we wouldn't get as many readers. And that the market would do that, but we don't do that, so it's not really equivalent, and we don't, and it would be visible. So part of the Facebook problem is the invisibility of its machine, you know, of how it works, how the algorithm works, how the extreme. But there are now dozens of books on the subject,
and of course we find, you know, we have sort of parallel national security concern about the use of sort of the popularity of technologies in the U.S. that are controlled by foreign firms that are not necessarily intelligence contractors, but often regimes that require them to be responsive to the state.
Right.
So this was the controversy over TikTok and WeChat that emerged. We are running a little low on time. I want to turn back to Cash and see if she had a final thought before we had to close down for a few minutes.
Just on the kind of international, you know, I'm working on this book about face recognition, so I am obsessed with face recognition right now. But I do just keep thinking about a world of interlocking, you know, surveillance cameras that are everywhere, where people's faces just are, can be tracked anywhere in the world. I wrote about a case earlier this year, some protesters in Minneapolis during the George Floyd protest, who there was camera footage clearly implicated. It was a couple, the man in setting fires at a Goodwill in a high school, and ATF was trying to find them, and they fled and went down to Mexico. And US authorities went to Mexico and gave them their photos and said, please, you know, run these and look for them. And that they did eventually find them in Mexico. I don't think it was due to facial recognition that I could find out, but that we could have that world where, you know, no matter where you go, what you are wanted for, why somebody wants to track you, it would be possible to track you. And I just think that, you know, and whether ClearView AI goes into everybody's hands. I mean, we've been talking about just as a law enforcement tool, but this could be something we all use, that you're just no longer able to be anonymous in public. These surveillance tools, you know, they might not just stay in law enforcement hands. They may trickle down into the general public. And just thinking about how they could be used one day.
Yeah, this is a sobering thought to end on. Well, thank you so much, Kashmir and Dana Priest. And we're going to take a short 15-minute break, but we will reconvene shortly for our morning block of flash talks, which I think are due to be fascinating. So please tune back in just about 15 minutes, and we'll see you there.